You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It is my great pleasure tonight to welcome Eric Overmeyer and Candy Alexander and Josh Kuhn to discuss New Orleans post-Katrina. As Nancy Franklin wrote in The New Yorker, it's one thing to take us to New Orleans. Anyone can do that, but not everyone can take us inside New Orleans. The HBO series Tremé, co-created by David Simon and Eric Overmeyer, does just that. And tonight we're so honored to host Eric Overmeyer, Candy Alexander, and Josh Kuhn of USC's Popular Music Project to discuss catastrophe, survival, music, and renewal, New Orleans culture post-Katrina. Music is entwined in New Orleans history. New Orleans inhales and exhales music, jazz, rhythm and blues, rock and roll and funk. And in the HBO series Tremé, named for one of New Orleans' working class neighborhoods, music and musicians take center stage as the city struggles to recover in the wake of the 2005 disaster. Salon's TV critic Heather Havrilsky has praised the series as TV storytelling at its finest. Simon and Overmeyer offer up such an intimate portrait of this strange, soulful American city that watching it makes you feel you're there. Suddenly, all the talk of the uniqueness of New Orleans culture, the passionate embrace of its music, the struggle to revive the Lower Ninth Ward and bring its natives back home in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, all of it comes together and you can feel the heartbreak of the city from the second line parade that opens the first 80-minute episode to the slow funeral procession that ends it. Eric Overmeyer, along with co-creator David Simon, was recently awarded Ambassador of New Orleans Music Award at the 2011 Big Easy Music Awards. Eric has written and produced extensively for film and television. He's also an award-winning playwright. His most produced play, On the Verge, has been performed extensively throughout the United States, Canada, and abroad. Eric lives part-time in New Orleans and used his experience in navigating the ornate oral tradition of the city's stories to create Tremé. So if you want to know where the best gumbo is, or where to get the best beignets, Eric's the man to ask. Or where to hear the best jazz. Josh Kuhn is director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's the Norman Lear Center, and his research focuses on the arts and politics of cultural connection, with an emphasis on popular music, the cultures of globalization, the U.S.-Mexico border, and Jewish musical history. He's also been teaching using Tremé in his classes when he does a section on New Orleans music. He's the author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, which won a 2006 American Book Award, and it's always a blast to collaborate with Josh. And we're very honored to have Candy Alexander here tonight, who shines in the role of LaDonna Batiste Williams on Tremé. Candy began her career as a dancer on Broadway, appeared in the original Tony Award-winning Broadway production of Dreamgirls, and is choreographed for Whitney Houston. She starred for 6 years as chief medical examiner Dr. Alex Woods on the hit CBS television drama CSI Miami, and you probably have also seen her on ER and News Radio. So onwards to New Orleans. Please welcome Eric Overmeyer, Josh Kuhn, and Candy Alexander. Thank you.
Good evening. How's everybody? Good. How many Tremé fans? Should we be careful about spoilers? Is everyone caught up? Everyone's caught up? Last night? No. All right.
We'll just talk about season one.
They all move. No, I'm kidding. So we thought we would actually start our conversation by starting at the beginning. Of the show itself. And we wanted to actually just refresh everyone's memory about how this show actually started, the very first images and first sounds that viewers saw. And we kind of want to relive that with you all and then start the conversation from there. So this is how the show, this is the first stuff that anybody saw from the show.
You're not in it. Mr. Chapman. In fact, is he appropriated that particular musical ornamentation for my repertoire?
I was hoping you would maybe share with us a little bit about why you thought it was significant to begin the show not only with a second line parade, but kind of second line parade and music in a particular space and that sense of movement and flow.
Well, we thought we set the pilot a few months after the storm, and one of the significant events of that first 6 months was the first second line after the storm, where a number of social aid and pleasure clubs got together and hired the Rebirth Brass Band. That's who is playing in that scene. And they started the second line in one of the wrecked neighborhoods. Well, most of the neighborhoods were wrecked, but they started it in one of the wrecked neighborhoods. So we kind of recreated that event. We cheated the timeline a little bit and so on, but it seemed to me to be, it seemed to us to be a really important event in the people who make the culture, they're reasserting for the city and for their culture, for what they do. And one of the deep secrets of New Orleans culture is that it's participatory. A second line means just that. The parade comes by and you jump in. You don't just watch it. You get in it. And that's the second line. The second line are the people following behind the band. And it's the key to Mardi Gras as well, which is Mardi Gras is nothing unless you put on a costume and a mask and get out in the street. And parades are, New Orleanians are parade crazy. So so that was part of that scene. The other part is Wendell Pierce, who's a New Orleans native, who plays Antoine Baptiste, the trombone player. That's a gig. And that's an important, and he's late for it. That's why he's running to catch up with the band. He's late for his gig. And he's talking about a very small amount of money when he says, play for that money, boys. But it's all for the love of it, really. I mean, it's their profession, but it's, you know, it's $50 a man probably or something like that. So Anyway, for all those reasons, and to show, to have that event parading through those absolutely devastated neighborhoods with whoever was around at that time, jumping in and celebrating that moment was important.
And I think was struck just as a viewer of kind of not beginning the show in silence that then becomes music, but that the show begins in music. And it begins kind of in that flow that we follow him into the second line.
Yeah, I think we didn't see the beginning of it, where they negotiate the fee, right, and all that stuff. But I think it actually does begin with a car radio and mm-hmm. some musicians tuning up, yep, and all that sort of stuff. So,
And why Treme is the neighborhood to set this in for you guys?
Treme is one of the Creole faubourgs, which are just around the French Quarter, the other oldest neighborhoods, and really the seedbeds of New Orleans culture. People of color, free people of color, immigrants, all the sort of Creolization that happens in New Orleans happened in those neighborhoods. Those were the neighborhoods where European musical instruments and military brass bands turned into New Orleans jazz as the as that kind of process between black and white happened in New Orleans. And we just felt like it stood for the way culture is made, the history of culture, the repository of musical culture in New Orleans. And we had to call it something. and the other neighborhoods, Marigny is too hard to pronounce. And Bywater sounds bad, so Treme is a nice... Also, Treme is the site of Congo Square, which is probably the most important historical site for New Orleans culture, African-American culture in this country, on this continent.
And now, am I remembering correctly that this Second Line Parade ends or moves underneath the interstate?
It does,
under
yeah.
I-10?
It goes on. And the Second Line Parades go on for miles and miles and hours and hours. And the other thing I should say about them is they're sponsored by Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs. They hire a band, they schedule their annual parade, and they go out. And the parading season goes from Labor Day to May, sometime in the spring. So, it's woven into the fabric of New Orleans, the parading schedule.
And I bring up the interstate and the bridge and the importance of them playing under the bridge also because I think it's an interesting moment in one of the many interesting moments in the show where that interstate kind of cut the neighborhood, historically cut the neighborhood off.
Well, yeah. Claiborne Avenue was a grand avenue through the back of Treme. It was an African-American lined with businesses, great oak trees, and the interstate was put through there during the early 60s, I believe. And it was an outrageous crime. What's interesting to me and very touching to me is that on the pillars of the interstate are painted, someone has painted murals of oak trees. And families still gather under there. The bands still play under there. Actually, the sound is great. There's always a silver lining to these things. And it's still a traditional place for black Mardi Gras to happen. This was during the heyday of Robert Moses, so we're well aware of these kinds of crimes in New York, too. But there was a proposal at the same time to put an interstate, just after that, an interstate through the heart of the French Quarter, which was thwarted. I mean, that would have destroyed New Orleans completely. Right. But anyway, there have been now there's talk about taking that down and trying to restore that section of Claiborne. So that would be a very expensive thing, but it's on people's minds.
Right. So it's, I think what's also interesting about that, the bridge and its connection to kind of pre-storm New Orleans and the kind of politics of race and geography in the city is that the show, I think, does a really impressive job at not focusing on post-storm New Orleans as if it exists separate from what the kind of long history, both cultural history, but also political history in the city.
Well, I think that's the whole raison d'etre of the show is continuity, disruption. New Orleans is a place of such continuity and tradition, especially in the musical culture. It's rooted in families, and the great concern after the storm was that rift would be total. That break would be irreparable. And I think it's proved not to be. I think there are a remarkable number of musicians back and families reestablished who are back to doing what they do. New Orleans is a very resilient place. And people are so attached to it that they really... Now, some people have not come back. Some people have discovered the joys of good schools and proper medical care and...
Diet.
And better diet and sort of reasonably clean politics and are not coming back. They've settled, they're not coming back. But a lot of people have come back. So
Candy, as an actor working on a show that is not just any old show, but is a show that is choosing to bear quite a bit of weight and responsibility to speaking to social issues and speaking to the long history of this place that neither of you are now, perhaps, but we're not locals or natives to. As an actor, what was that like to walk into this experience?
I had the good fortune, the producers allowed me to come to New Orleans 1 month prior to filming. And the night that I got there, they wouldn't let me go to the hotel to check in. I could only leave my luggage, and they took me immediately to a parade. And then after the parade, we had a full dinner. And after the dinner, they told me they were going to pick me up in the morning, and it began. And I worked all the bars, all during Mardi Gras. I slung drinks, and which was quite interesting. And
what did you learn slinging drinks?
I learned that I had to share my tips because everybody knew I was on TV, but the other girls, I wasn't going to make it out alive because they actually had kids. They weren't pretending.
Did you have to get queens on them at all? Or
no? Oh, you don't understand, because everybody wanted the girl from CSI Miami to serve them a drink. So it was right at that time I had left that show and before we filmed Treme. So it was, I'm from Queens, so that helped, you know. I was, you know, I could stand up. It was good. But yes, just, you know, learning so much, and slowly the women especially would open up. They would open up and share intimate things that happened and how they felt. And one minute they were just flooded with emotion and tears and go away that quickly. They needed to cover it. I found that the alcoholism was unbelievable, just devastating. You know, to watch it on a daily basis was interesting.
You did learn how to pronounce Baton Rouge. Too.
Baton Rouge.
Yeah, you're right.
Baton Rouge.
So maybe this is, I guess, a question for both of you, but kind of picking up on this same idea. What, because of the nature of the show, because the show was a kind of, in a way, the many things that it is a kind of direct response to a political event or a social event, natural event, a rupture. Was there a different sense of responsibility toward representation of realness? And I know that the show has caused lots of debates about kind of spotting authenticity. And I'm just wondering, as a someone behind the camera and someone in front of the camera, are those things that go through your mind in terms of we need to get certain things right? Or, I mean, clearly you put a ton of research into shooting the show.
Well, you know, I think David and I started talking about doing a show in New Orleans back in the 90s. Because we both loved it, and we felt it had never been conveyed very accurately on film or on television. So I think we would have had the same obsessive attention to detail, even if we were doing a show that, if the storm had never happened and we were doing a show about musicians in New Orleans, which is what we had come to before the storm. So because we felt very passionate about trying to, we didn't know if you could do it. We didn't know if you could convey New Orleans to someone who hadn't been there. And I wish that there was, that smell-o-vision had been invented by now, because I know that if we could convey the smells of New Orleans cooking, we'd be set, you know. But, or there are other smells too. So that attention to detail, I think, was never even a question. It's just part of the mission. Mm-hmm. That being said, we're continually saying it's a fiction, it's a drama. We're allowed to do anything we want. Leave us alone. And that's a kind of an ongoing debate with New Orleanians, especially about, well, that never happened, or that didn't happen, or
but
that didn't happen at that time.
Right. You know? But there is some blurring, because you have characters who are based on, seemingly based on,
I keep saying they're inspired by.
Inspired by.
Because based
yes.
on sounds
True.
Like, and in fact, there are a handful. There are two or three. But as soon as you cast an actor, you immediately start to move away from that. And you start, in television especially, serious television, you write to the actor. You see them all the time. You hear them. They're Candy Alexander is in my ear as LaDonna. No, and you write to that. You write to, it's an ongoing dynamic, and we're responding to her, she's responding to us. And so those three or four characters that were inspired by actual New Orleanians have really moved far away from their real life starting points.
Yeah. I would like to answer as well. I felt a deep obligation, and it's one of the joys that I have as an actor, is to find the physical embodiment of my character, because it takes me deeper than just, you know, where I can imagine she is and the pieces of human beings that I grab here and there. So I went out looking for her, and I found her, and I bought the clothes off of her back, and I wore them for a week, and I just lived as her.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. I found her, and I just lived as I didn't. That was it. I found her. That was it. Mm. Yeah. And I had to fight for her, too, because the wardrobe department and the hair department, they saw her differently. So I had to fight for the reality of who she, what she looked like, the physical embodiment of this woman, yeah.
One of the things, I was telling Eric this last night, that every time I watch the show, I'm reminded at kind of how, what kind of, I'm repeatedly stunned that it's on television. That there is a show that is on every week that is responding to, or actually addressing, an extreme wound within American politics, an extreme wound within American culture, a crisis that people are still healing from. And the kind of courage to address that week after week, and both for those of you who work on the show, but also for HBO to allow it to be on that, to be on, I think is something we don't get that reminder of kind of political, ethical responsibilities enough. And one of the things that, one of the ways that you deal with that in a very, I think, strategic way is how you use music as a kind of response to that wound, or as a medicine of healing in a lot of ways. And unlike a lot of shows that use music as a soundtrack, that's not how music functions in this show. Music, I was struggling to figure out how to actually express it, but music is, it is the show in a way. It is the life. And so I want to know how much of that is about representing the role of music in New Orleans.
It's, I think it's all about that. The first time I visited New Orleans was 76, I think. But I'd had a fascination with it since I was about 12. My father came home from New Orleans on a, he worked for Boeing in Seattle. And he came home from a business trip with a handful of record albums, and I played him to death. And I think that started me. He had some pralines, too. so between those two, I thought, this is pretty interesting. But the first time I went there, I was struck by how much music there was everywhere. And there were people playing on the street. There were people playing in every club. You could, unlike New York, which is a big deal to go see music anytime, and fewer places now, but even back in the 70s and 80s, it was a thing, you know, to go to the Blue Note or Tramps or the Lone Star and fight the crowd and pay the cover and buy the minimum drinks. And you did it, but it was a chore in some ways, bottom line. In New Orleans, you just walked in. If there was a cover, it was a couple of bucks. And there was somebody you never heard of who was fantastic. I mean, it just breathed music all the time, and food. And so it seemed natural to center a show. David and I did not want to do another cop show. We didn't want to do a doctor show or a lawyer show. So we sort of, what did we love about New Orleans? Well, music and food. So cooks and musicians, chefs and musicians. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you could do a show about New Orleans without doing, without putting music at the center of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what drives it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, when I watch it, it's this great reminder of music, that it's not music always as entertainment.
Yeah.
But it's music as life.
It's music as life. And music in the broadest sense, including the Mardi Gras Indians and the parades and
jazz funerals.
Jazz funerals, marching bands, and all that stuff.
Should we watch maybe this next clip, which I think is a really great example of the way that music is life?
Yeah, and just let me preface it by saying, you saw Antoine Baptiste, Wendell Pierce's character, at the top of, this is also from the pilot, it's the last scene. The first scene, he was playing a second line. In the second in this last scene of the pilot, he's got another gig. He's playing a funeral. He doesn't know the person being buried. And he's late. So.
Should we take a look at the next clip?
Give me the 20. Then get out of the cab. You ain't gotta be like that, bro. Hey, give me a call or something. I'll mail you the 6. I will. I'll go, man. Like I'm a damn fool. Hey, Bunchy.
What's up?
How you been, mate?
I'm good, man. I'm trying to get this world a mess, bro.
I hear you.
Thanks for making a short notice, man. Uh-huh. Aaron took sick this morning, bro.
Bro, look, I'm glad for the gig.
Got it.
Who going home?
Bojack going home.
Bojack? From Over Algiers?
No, man. Bojack from Girdtown.
Oh, the one that plays sax with Huey Smith?
No, bro. The one who stole calls for the motherfuckers down to save a lot of time. You know, man. This happy nephew.
Huh?
The big head motherfucker with the lazy eye.
Yeah, I thought he'd been dead.
No, but he was used to that. He fucked around, got himself shot to death, and went to telephone with old Paul's, man. So now you're on the stick.
Yeah, I heard that. It's 40 to the graveyard, right? And 40 to Cakewalk back, right?
That's it, cuz.
All right.
Here, Duane Baptiste.
Benny Jones.
Close the wall to start.
All right.
Can you feel comfortable with that?
I'll flat that B, Bunchy. Play for that money, boys. Play for it.
This is not the only, within the arc of the series, this is not the only jazz funeral scene that we see.
No, we'll actually see a clip from another, and he mentions the structure of it. They're coming out of the church, they're doing the dirge to the cemetery. Then once the deceased is buried or encrypted, that's not right. they'll do the cakewalk back, and I think that's what we see in the next clip, is the cakewalk part of a different jazz funeral.
So before, when we were looking at the clips, when we were talking about the first clip that we saw, you said something to the effect of that as much as you liked that the way that you guys shot it. You would rather shoot it again in a different way, but thought you got this one right.
Yeah, I love this one because I feel like we captured something, as paradoxical as it seems, because it was staged, we captured something authentic about New Orleans. Well, all we did was turn the camera on. That was the Tremé Brass Band and the Sudan Social Aid and Pleasure Club. And the Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs not only do their own second lines, but they also, Bojack with the lazy eye must have been a member of the Sudan Pleasure Club because they're helping to bury him. So they were benevolent societies formed to help people with funeral expenses and all kinds of things. So all those people, aside from Wendell, are real musicians, real Social Aid and Pleasure Club people. So we just had to get out of their way and let them do what they do. And I love the slow procession as they come, that sort of side-to-side step as they come down the street. It's a thrilling moment.
Because of the kind of focus on music and of the kind of cultural histories and cultural performances that the show really anchors itself to, one of the plot lines that's really developed this season is kind of around the question of rebuilding the city and what you should invest in. Investing in buildings, investing in culture. Was that an either or for you guys, or was that actually something you were responding to in terms of the history of trying to rebuild the city? About the, you know, what do you invest in? Do you invest in music and culture?
Well, it's a question that's been exacerbated by the storm, but it certainly existed before the storm. It's always been puzzling to me ever since I've been in New Orleans, 20 some years now, how little regard a certain part of the city has for its own culture and for musicians and people, Mardi Gras Indians and so on. And you do hear people say, if only we were more like Houston or Atlanta. You know, nothing against Houston or Atlanta, but why would that be a good thing? There's already a Houston and there's already an Atlanta, so... That question of what to invest in, there's a very interesting book by a man named James Gill called Lords of Misrule, which I recommend to you all. It's about Mardi Gras culture going way back to the 1800s. And he posits that Mardi Gras is partly to blame for the decrepit state of the city, that people invest in Mardi Gras rather than schools. I mean, that's putting it too crudely, but there's something to be said for that. It's a very complex question. Mm-hmm. A lot of what makes New Orleans New Orleans is poverty. That is part of the culture. It's part of the historical preservation. That a lot of investment schemes come and go because the money can't be got together or because the corruption prevents it from happening. So, you know, it's all very tangled.
And tourism? It's part of that.
Tourism story. Is part of it. That's certainly a double-edged sword, you know, in terms of preserving or destroying the culture. It's very entangled. I can't make sense of it. All we do is kind of poke at it.
Right. And, so, you know, a part of that double-edged sword, of course, is this, I think, the event that is such a tourist event on the one hand and is such a long-standing kind of cultural, key core cultural event in the city is Mardi Gras, which it kind of forms some degree of the kind of temporal framing of the series.
Well, as it does the New Orleans calendar. I mean, everything is leading up to and receding away from Mardi Gras, Carnival. Carnival is really the more appropriate term because it's a whole season of parading and overindulging. And there are many different Mardi Gras within, you know, the Bourbon Street Girls Gone Wild Mardi Gras is one. And that's sort of where the tourists go. But there are all these other Mardi Gras that are for New Orleanians. Mm-hmm. And they're very important. I mean, that event is very, very important. I went to the first Mardi Gras after the storm, and it was quite a move. It was a beautiful day, and people had driven from Houston and Atlanta and further just for the day, just to come back and see people. In the first season's Mardi Gras episode, LaDonna runs into someone she hasn't seen since the storm. And you saw that all day long happening. It was important for people to come back.
We have a short clip of
we have a little clip of Kim Dickens, the chef, has she cooked during the morning and then she slipped into her Mardi Gras costume. She's gone to a party. She's eating a magic brownie. And when this clip happens, she's trying to turn a parked car into a yellow taxi cab to take her home.
So. Let's watch.
Alakazam, Shakamofi Nande.
What you doing, darling?
I'm turning this ordinary car into a taxi cab.
Good luck, baby.
My fly boy and your fly boy sitting on the bayou. My fly boy to your fly boy. I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about Anna, Anna. I go echo on it. Shakamofi no Anna. Shakamofi Nande.
I was telling Josh I was a little sorry that we faded out quite so soon, because those three people who come up behind her, if you go back and look at the episode, they start singing Aiko Aiko with her. They were not extras. They were people walking down the street while we were filming. And it was such a perfect New Orleans moment. They didn't even notice the camera. They'd all been drinking. Oh, a parade. And and it only happened that one time because they drifted off down, you know, into the night. But that's the take we loved, so we kept it.
One of the things that the show does so well and pays such close attention to, is, as you already mentioned, is the tradition of the Mardi Gras Indians. Mm. Among the rich music that's included and packed into every episode, I think I'm probably wrong, but I think the song that is repeated the most in different versions, perhaps, is My Indian Red.
I think we did four different versions, the first season, yeah.
So I wanted to just to remind people about it, because it kind of creeps in different ways throughout the show, to play the first recording of it, the Danny Barker.
It's the first one I know that's not that's in song form, as opposed to sort of a field recording of a chant.
Okay. So this is Danny Barker.
There goes the big chief, the big chief, the yellow Pocahontas, the pretty monogram hollers, and
they don't bow down
on nobody's ground. Oh, how we love to hear you call us Indian Red. The wild Squatuna, the white eagle, the pretty eight-ball hunters, the wild West Shoshone hunters, and
we don't bow down
on nobody's ground. Oh, how we love to hear you call us Indian Red. Here comes the spy boy, the flag boy. Watch that crazy wild man, the wildest in the lowlands. And you love our queen,
queen of New Orleans.
Oh, how we love to hear you call us Indian Red.
So why is this song so important, or had it become so important for you in the show?
Well, we all love this song. It's one of the Dr. John says it's one of the sacred songs of the Mardi Gras Indians. That's probably true. There are a number of Mardi Gras Indian songs we love, but Indian Red's, I don't know, it's the primary.
Right.
It's the primary song. That Danny Barker was born in the French Quarter. He's from a musical family, the Barberin family, Creole family. He's a towering figure in New Orleans music in all kinds of ways, one of which was he started teaching, he revived the old brass band tradition. with all these kids who later on grew up to be the Dirty Dozen, and all kinds of very important New Orleans musicians went through his band that he formed. He was here in New York as well. He was an important musician in New York for a while. So that recording calls up all kinds of things for me, including that sort of family tradition that runs through all these families in New Orleans. The Neville brothers are the most famous, but there are just tons of them. And once you start, we cast this kid in the second season. If any of you have seen the first episode, he's the kid who's practicing Saints and driving everybody crazy. Well, only later on we found out that he was the nephew of Big Sam Williams, who's in the first season and has Big Sam's Funky Nation. And you're always finding out, one of the kids who plays one of LaDonna's kids, the younger one, is the grandson of Willie T, who is a very important music person in New Orleans in terms of, and he worked with the Wild Magnolias on their first funk album, putting funk in back in the 70s. You find out everybody's related to everybody. So you better be careful if you're right. Talking trash about somebody, because they'll say, inevitably they'll say, that's my cousin.
Right. I mean, you know, when you look at try to learn about the history of the Mardi Gras Indians, it's actually not an easy task.
No. Because they all have a different history, a different version of the history, and also they lie to you.
Right. There's that. And most of the documentation has actually come from outside of Mardi Gras Indians. That there's right. very little that's been self-documented from within.
Right.
So as an actor, Candy, I mean, when encountering not just New Orleans, but all of these kind of subcultures and communities within New Orleans culture, what's your approach to that, to kind of encountering that? Is it do you approach it as an outsider who respects it and learns, or what's the approach?
Well, originally I do, and then somehow I'm drawn in. Like in the scene with Wendell and Ike,
that was Ike, the taxi driver.
Okay, Ike, he works at a place called Redfish Grill on Bourbon. And he's just this wonderful character. And before we filmed an episode during the first season where we dealt with the Creoles, my husband's family is Creole.
Hey, well, hey, Lance.
Lance is
here. Lance Nichols, who plays Larry Williams.
And I happened to be there one evening having dinner, and this is before we even filmed it, so he didn't know it was coming up, and he just started talking trash about these Creoles and who they think they are.
Ike did.
Oh, it turns out one of the managers at the restaurant was Creole, so I just sort of like fell into it, like, wait, what? I just read that. We haven't filmed it yet. So I started going back regularly and kind of hanging out and going, yeah, who she thinks she is? So I can find out. Right. So I started out as an outsider and just kind of, you know, get your way in there up under that nail and find out what the real story is.
Were there any moments of we're not letting you in?
Yes, there were many moments of, especially once the show aired, first season. We were there during the first episode, the first season, we were there. The first episode aired, we were still there filming.
We were, yeah.
And I was, there's a place that a gym, the Canal Street gym that I work out regularly. And the day after the first episode aired, no one was very nice to me. And these are people I've been working out with for almost 7 months and seeing every day and hey. And all of a sudden they were like, and I thought, oh my God, do they hate the show? What is it? And I couldn't put myself out there because we were still filming and I couldn't be that sensitive. You know, I couldn't let them affect my performance. So I just stopped going back. And then Steve Zahn started going to the gym. And he came to my trailer one day and he said, they all miss you. They just don't know how to deal with it because you come and you're so happy and they see you on the show and you're this bitch. So they don't know who you are. Like, you're always smiling and on the show you're cursing and... So you have these weird dynamics that are constantly going on.
Right. Well, they have, you know, they have the usual problem that people have with people on television, that you've been in their living room, so they feel like they know you. So they have that regular. And then also, and then in New Orleans, I think it's a double thing because of the storm, and they relate to you in a very personal way. But I know during the first season, there was a horrific event that happened in 2006, about a year after the storm, where this guy killed his girlfriend in the quarter and chopped her up, put her on this, you know, he didn't eat her, but he did put her in big pots on the stove. And they were convinced that we were going to do that story, that Sonny was going to do that to Annie, all the whole first season. And we had never even crossed our mind. And I know that Michael, people would come up to him in the grocery store and say, "Don't you do it." "I know you're going to do it. Don't do it."
Right. So there is this a total awareness that there's a kind of dynamic, organic, living connection between the show and...
Yeah, and it's sort of wonderful. And I've heard people say they watch the show and somebody coined the phrase, "Tremeja vu." I'm having tremeja vu. We didn't, but right. New Orleanians have, you know, that it takes them back.
So this might sound like an odd question, but is there, because the show is set or begins soon after the storm, but yet you're shooting it considerably far after the storm, or comparatively.
We're 4 years out every season, 4 years after the fact.
And so did you, so in terms of sets and in terms of how you're shooting, in a way, were there moments of having to turn the clock back in terms of what the city looked like?
Oh, yeah, especially the first season. And we would have to come to a neighborhood that had been restored and gack it up, you know, put debris on the street. And, of course, people hated that.
Right.
It was awful for them. And so we tried to cover it if we weren't there and clean it up as quickly as we could. And especially the pilot in the first season, there were plenty of places that we could shoot that looked like the day after the storm. And there's still some areas like that, but they're disappearing as buildings get torn down or rebuilt. But it's an odd thing to be doing a period piece, but it's only 4 years in the past.
Right.
You're constantly checking if the Apple computer is correct, because it's that kind of stuff that changes really quickly. And there are people on the internet who have no lives, and they just...
Oh, my God.
They're looking for, you know...
I want to get you.
They'll get you. The continuity errors and, oh, you know, that Mac didn't exist.
One of the things I really love about the funeral scene that we just saw moments ago is when Antoine says, "Who's going home?" And that, the recurring theme of going home.
Yeah. Has a number of different meanings.
Number of different meanings, going home... Upstairs, downstairs, going home to your hometown.
Coming home. You home yet? You hear that a lot. You home yet?
Yeah. And I wanted to. I was thinking that there is this scene, the other jazz funeral scene, where your character is mourning, and is mourning as she's walking, and we kind of get to watch in this really beautiful. Beautifully shot scene, how music turns mourning as grief into mourning as triumph or survival or a different kind of coming home. And so I thought maybe we'd watch that. And it, I just think if you and this is where Candy's Broadway, but I'm going to actually posit the Whitney Houston chops.
Wait a minute.
Come out. Yeah. Choreography chops.
Choreography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
never seen it.
Someday you need to watch it.
Now, Candy, I know you've watched that scene about 10 times. You've never watched it?
No.
Can you walk us through what it was like performing it?
Okay. Whew. I'd gone through this season with all this emotional angst with Damo. And at the same time...
Her brother.
Yeah. My brother on the show.
Right.
Which I had no idea. I didn't want to know what was going to happen. So I'm living the moments as I'm reading the scripts, as I'm doing the performance. But in real time... I had sold my house here in Los Angeles, so I was living in New Orleans. I wanted to really be respectful to the role and just be there, and I didn't have anywhere else to live anyway. And at the same time, my dad was dying. And so I was going through exactly what the character was going through. And I just decided to mesh, live it, own it. And the night that we filmed this, my father died. That night I got back. So as I was doing this, I was doing it for my dad in character as LaDonna. Yeah.
Well, you feel it as a viewer. I mean, it takes your breath out of you when you watch it.
I haven't seen it. I can't watch it.
I wanted to maybe just end with one last question before we open it up.
Sure.
Q&A. And in preparing for today, I ran across a line from the great Sidney Bechet, great jazz musician, who was talking about the history of...
Who was from Tremé, by the way.
From Tremé. As well as... Was Buddy Bolden from Tremé? Or
No, he was from back of town, it was called...
So Bechet is talking about the role of music in New Orleans, particularly after emancipation. And he says that what you hear in early New Orleans jazz, quote, trying to find out in the music what they, the musicians, were supposed to do with this freedom. And it struck me that there's a way of carrying that forward, that the show carries that forward, where music becomes trying to figure out what to do next, with either the freedom of being able to come back, these next steps, but using music as a way of actually, of like we said, of rebuilding communities and rebuilding selves. And I'm just wondering, in terms of these, the kind of longer New Orleans history of the politics of slavery, of the kind of the ghost of slavery as a past that is felt very in a very real way in the city every day. To what extent is this question of freedom one that resonates? There's even a Lil Wayne. We're not going to have time to listen to it, but there's a great Lil Wayne, Robin Thicke tune about Katrina, Tie My Hands, where Lil Wayne says, they talk that freedom at us and didn't even leave a ladder. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that we might want to kind of end on in terms of the show's relationship to this politics of freedom.
You know, we approach it through the characters. So David may have sort of bigger overarching conceptual themes, although he usually puts it in terms of urban, what's a city worth, how do we live together, sort of. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought about in the terms you're talking about. New Orleans is interesting because the position of people of color in New Orleans before the Civil War, before Reconstruction ended, was different than anywhere else in the country. Even slaves in New Orleans had a day off, Congo Square. Even slaves in New Orleans...
Sundays.
Yes, but yeah. Even slaves in New Orleans, certain slaves carried guns, had positions of responsibility in the household. You know, it was a whole different system. And you had this huge population, a very significant population of free people of color who were affluent, who were educated, who had freedom. It wasn't complete in the social hierarchy. They were second, but it was different than anywhere else in the country. So, and then during the Reconstruction, there was a great deal of political freedom and in New Orleans. All that was taken away, mm-hmm. right? But not forgotten.
Right.
So I think that is very evident in a lot of New Orleans culture, that sort of ferocity of remembrance of what was, what we had, what was lost, what we got back through really bitter struggle, mm-hmm. And what we, you know, in this season, Wendell is teaching a class of kids, and he makes them listen to Louis Armstrong, and he says, "See that right there? We invented that right here in New Orleans. You know, that's that kind of pride in culture." You know, I don't know. I'm sort of talking around your question a little bit because I don't quite know how to get at it. But it's just the sense I have, you know, that the past is very present in New Orleans. All of its triumph and all of its tragedy. So, and you see, you're just walking in the street, you feel it,
right.
And you hear it. You hear it in the music. I mean, there's stuff in that Danny Barker thing that you can hear today. The military drum. Second line drumming is there. The tune is exactly the same. I mean, that's kind of why we did Indian. We did Indian Red as a chant at a funeral for the Wild Man. We did Danny Barker being played on the radio. Donald Harrison did a sort of modern jazz version of it. And Dr. John did his version. Let's say sort of R&B version of it. So that's all about continuity and tradition, which is what the show is about.
Yeah. In that classroom scene, there with the Louis Armstrong, I think that's part of the same scene where then one of the students says,
I could play that.
I can play it. Give me the music, and I'll go home and learn it. And Antoine says, you know, there is nothing for you to go home and learn. You've got to live it.
You've got to live it. He's writing it as he plays it.
Writing it as he plays it. And to me, that's another way of talking about getting free.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I'm struck in all kinds of different versions of New Orleans music. The brass bands, the trad jazz bands. There's a theme. There's a sort of collective framework to the music, but within it, you have the New Orleans polyphony, where at some points all five guys are playing something different. Mm-hmm. That's part of the piece, and then they come back and do it. They play it as an ensemble, but that's very important in New Orleans, I think. Tell your business.
But then come back to the group.
And then come back to the group, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and arguably that's a definition, as many folks have said, of democracy, or a definition of community, of how you build
community. For sure.
Yeah. Thank you. So let's take some questions from the audience. We're not done yet.
You were kind.
There are microphones floating around.
In the microcosm of the culture of New Orleans, you bring in some outsiders. I'm thinking about the Dutch boy and the Latino from Texas.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we wanted from the beginning to have somebody, a European musician, and we happened upon Michel. We weren't sure who it was going to be, if it was going to be Annie or Sonny. And there's a long tradition of people coming from far away to live in New Orleans and play music because they love it, from Europe, from Japan. This season we feature a couple of people, a Japanese funk guitarist, Jun Yamagishi, who still doesn't speak English after all this time in New Orleans, but he's a fantastic player. But he's not the only one. There are like five Japanese guys playing with these funk bands. It's weird. And they're from Japan, you know? And there are European players who've been there along, John Cleary, piano player, and people like that. So that was something we wanted to represent. And then Hidalgo, the guy from Texas, there's been a huge influx of new people into the city, and some of that's very positive and some of it's not. There are all these young people who've come to town and who are playing music, and you see them on the street and they're dressed in Depression era clothes. They're playing acoustic music. They've dredged up these old records from the 20s. I don't know where they found them, and they can play. They're great. You know, So, and then the teachers and all the volunteer people come to rebuild and all that. So there's all that. And then there are people there for the gold rush, you know, to get to, there's money to be made, you know, in the reconstruction. So he's one of those guys. So it's just something that's going on there right now, that part of it, the new people in town. But New Orleans, as a port city, has always had influxes of waves of newcomers for one reason or another.
We were also talking, just to pick up on that last night, about also the other outsiders, the, you know, migrant laborers who come in, who are doing a lot of the work.
Yeah, there's a whole Latino thing in New Orleans that is new to New Orleans. It's not, you know, New Orleans has always had an odd connection to Honduras because of the United Fruit Company. Carlos Marcelo, the famous mafia boss, was actually born in Honduras, and at one point he was deported back there, even though he left there when he was 2 years old. But now they're workers from Mexico, Central America, and Brazil, as well as Latino workers from California and Texas. So that's a whole new vibrant thing in New Orleans. It's great, and they're being exploited by unscrupulous contractors, local contractors, and all that sort of thing as well.
Next question.
Hi. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about the title sequence. It's absolutely lovely. We watch it at the beginning of every show. Sorry. Should I ask again? Sorry. I was hoping you could tell me about the title sequence. I love it. I feel it. No?
Yeah, I will.
Oh.
we have, first of all, I really feel like we should start saying that we got the idea for the show from John Boutte's song, which he wrote back in 2003 or something. He wrote it as an industrial, and it's become this big hit for him. And I saw him at Jazz Fest, and he said, you know, if I'd known it was going to be a hit, I would have written more songs. it was just a job. And he used to play it at gigs, and he didn't get any response. Now at Jazz Fest, people went crazy. It was great. But the images, I think, are pretty unusual. It's slightly different from last year to this year. I don't know. Have you seen both seasons? The scenes of the dancers second lining, the older gent second lining, are both seasons, and they're from the New Orleans Historic Collection, the Jules Kahn collection. I think they go back to the 50s. But this season we concentrated on images of reconstruction, death, crime, homelessness, all sort of things that were going on during the time frame. And I think that the person who did both sequences is a woman named Karen Thorson, who worked with David Simon on The Wire in post-production. And she's just done a great job. It's an unusual title sequence because I don't think there are any shots from the show, at least this season. I think it's all footage and imagery from other places. It's not from our show. I don't think, and there might have been a little bit last season, but this season, no. So that's sort of unusual. And so we're just trying to let it resonate thematically. There's much less stuff about the hurricane this season, just that terrifying shot of how big it was over the Gulf of Mexico, and then the water rushing in, and the people looking at the mold, the couple looking at the mold in their house. But other than that, I think, we had more of that kind of stuff last season because it was closer to the time of the flood.
Other questions?
I've been really, really fascinated about the Indians, and I never knew anything about them. Could you tell us, and they seem to be apart and at odds with certain segments in the city. And could you just sort of fill in a little bit about them?
They're kind of mysterious. And we hired at the beginning, for the pilot, we hired Donald Harrison Jr. as a consultant. His father was a big chief He was big chief of the Guardians of the Flame, Donald Harrison Sr. Donald Harrison has his own gang or tribe called, what's it called? Congo Nation. But it was frustrating because Donald didn't trust us. So we'd ask him a question. We'd say, so what does Giacomo Finanè mean? And he'd say, well, I can't tell you. Well, what does it mean when the big chief goes, does that? And he'd say, I can't tell you. And we would say, you're our consultant. And finally, he got to trust us, and he would tell us a few things. And then we would sort of happen to be talking to another Mardi Gras Indian, and they would say, no, that's not right. So the more we got to know the Indians, the more confused we got. And we came to understand that we had to check with about 6 different people. Also, we showed the pilot to... Clark Peters is a wonderful song and dance man. He's done all this Broadway and stuff in London and the West End. So he seemed... And he's a wonderful actor. So we thought he would be right to play Lambro. And they were very... They said, you can't do that. You have to have a real Indian play the big chief. And we said, well, but we need an actor. And they said, well, can't do it. It won't be right. And we showed the pilot to a group. We invited a group of Indian, big chiefs, actually. There's also this whole downtown, uptown thing, which I can't even begin to get into. But there were some downtown chiefs and some uptown chiefs. And they all looked at it. And the one thing they agreed on was that he wasn't enough of a big chief. We had staged the thing wrong. It's the scene in the pilot where he comes out of the dark and he talks to Robinette. So we went back and reshot the whole thing because they were right, and Clark knew it too. He didn't have enough authority. And we'd staged it so Robinette was up above him. That would never happen. So we took their notes, and we went back, and we shot the whole thing. And I think that gradually we've kind of won them over, also by including them in a number of scenes. And all the guys around Lambro's tribe are real Mardi Gras Indians. And they all disagree about everything. It's kind of hilarious, actually. So you could see how in the old days, when they met, the uptown Indians and the downtown Indians would meet. Actually, coming back to a place called Hunter's Field, which is under the freeway, they would meet. In the old days, one of the reasons that some segments of society, to get back to the other part of your question, in New Orleans, the Indians were not reputable because they would fight with bottles and knives and guns. They don't do that anymore. There was a very influential figure named Tutti Montana, who was the chief of chiefs and the head of the Yellow Pocahontas, which Danny Barker, that's the first tribe Danny Barker mentions, and they're still around. He sort of converted all of this fighting into symbolic posturing. So now they posture, and they sing, and it's all about who's the prettiest. So you see all these very tough guys, working class guys, who spend all year sewing their... talking about, I'm the prettiest. It's pretty great. And they really sew. You know, it was one of the best moments for me, the very first scene we had during the first season where Lambro and his tribe are sewing. Lonzo Wilson, our brilliant costume designer, brought all this material stuff and put it in front of Otto Dejean and Walter and Eddie and all these guys who are real Indians. They just picked it up and started sewing before the cameras were on or anything. It was fantastic. That's what you do, you know, and you do it every day of the year practically. So it's a really amazing culture. And one of the things I hope that we get to next year is Super Sunday, which is one of the days that everybody comes out in their suits. It's after Mardi Gras. It's mysteriously related to St. Joseph's Day, which is a Sicilian holiday in New Orleans, March 19th. So you have St. Patrick's Day, the Irish parades where they're throwing cabbages and potatoes and things to make stew with. And then you had St. Joseph's Night, where the Indians come out, and then Super Sunday, which is also a few days after St. Joe's. And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I mean, there are hundreds of Indians in the street. It's remarkable. Now, there are people in New Orleans who've never seen the Indians parade. They get really excited when they hear, oh, the Indians are coming. That's a very classic New Orleans phrase. Indians are coming, Indians are coming. Everybody rushes out to see them because they're so amazing. But, you know, there are people who've just never gone to the traditional neighborhoods to see them because they think it's dangerous. There's a segment in sort of middle-class black New Orleans that has always thought the Indians were disreputable. And I've been told numerous times by sort of middle-aged people, oh, I had to sneak out to see the Indians because my parents didn't approve. That's sort of faded now, especially now that it's become less dangerous. I mean, it doesn't end in violence. It's something, you know, and it has connections to Brazilian carnival and Trinidad carnival, and here it is in the United States. It's really remarkable.
Is there one history? Because I've read multiple kind of origin stories.
Oh,
is
the
there
origin. One? Yeah, you want to start a fight.
Okay.
Well, not with me. With Indians, talk about, you know, one of the theories that has fallen out of favor was that it was Buffalo Bill's Wild West show.
Right.
Now, privately, some Indians will say, yeah, it was Buffalo. but don't quote me because And other people say, no, it goes further back. Willis Eli, who works with us, he says that the Indian became a figure in European carnival in the late 1600s, as soon as the New World was discovered. So suddenly there were Indians in Florence and Venice and Paris during carnival. It became a, you know, the Tempest, Shakespeare, suddenly, you know. So who knows?
And there's the runaway slave.
The runaway slave being sheltered by the Indians, and that has some, you know, it's probably some combination of all those things. But it's lost in time. But ask any Indian, they will give you a definitive answer.
Okay, yes. So.
I'd like both Candy and Eric to comment on whether you feel that by having a creative outlet, whether it's acting and dancing for Candy or writing for Eric, does that give you an advantage in the face of either general disaster like a hurricane or personal disaster like facing the death of a father compared to people who don't have talent and an outlet to express it?
I think everyone has a talent. Some people, they're creative cooks, you know, it's an expression of heart and art for them. I think everyone has some form of hidden talent, but I do find for myself sometimes it does get in the way because being a New Yorker, when 9/11 happened, I was working in Los Angeles. I didn't know what to do. I just wanted to go home, and I couldn't get there. And I had nowhere to take the emotion, and I was on high drama, you know, internally with nowhere to put it. So I'm not sure. Sometimes it does work for you, and no, sometimes it's not good in a long-term relationship situation. A lot of different personalities going on. But in this case, in this particular piece, it divine hand worked its way out for me.
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, it finds its way into scripts eventually. You know. So maybe it's helpful. Maybe I would drink more if I didn't write. Although writing drives me to drink sometimes.
I wanted to ask about the John Goodman character.
Mm-hmm.
He has a good relationship with his wife and his child. I know he's frustrated and angry, but beside the fact
why did he do what he did?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because New Orleanians got it. And there was a huge spike in that. Has everybody seen the first season?
No.
Okay, well.
Uh-oh.
Okay, spoiler alert. You know, I was just in France, and somebody asked this question, and I completely spoiled it. And all these people came up to me and said, well, you know, fuck you very much. I'm only at episode 7. As I said it in French, it sounded better. Anyway, there was a great deal of mental anguish with people who seemed to be comfortable and seemed to be, have not lost, but the disruption in their lives was really severe for everybody, no matter what their material circumstances were. So I think we were not off base with what happened to that character, with what he did.
We out of time, Louise? One more? One more?
How about from Lance?
Lance. Lance Nichols.
I'm not talking about your character, though.
Oh, he threw in the towel over there.
Okay.
Sure.
Oh, sure.
I wanted to say, being a native of New Orleans, there was always a concern whenever a TV show or a movie would come to town to shoot, because there were so many really bad stereotypes of what people thought New Orleans was about, from the Big Easy.
Oh, Cher, you don't mean that.
Yeah, Cher, I mean that, yeah. To a TV series that came in about a year after Katrina. And there were references to gumbo parties and ridiculous things like that. Tabasco and oatmeal, thank you for telling me about that one. So when I heard that David and Eric were coming to town to do a show, I was hoping that they would at least make an attempt to get it right. And they have. They've gotten it right, both the good and the bad. The beautiful and not so beautiful. And the reason why they got it right is because they cared enough to sit down with the people there and talk to them and get their story. There's one incident in particular that I think about that happened last season. For those of you who saw the finale, when LaDonna has a flashback to the evacuation scene. Well, I was actually there. I evacuated with my family. There were 12 of us in 3 vehicles, and we got out the day before Katrina hit. We were shooting that scene at a gas station outside of New Orleans, and there must have been about 300 extras involved in that scene, as well as Candy and I and the 2 boys and the actress who plays the mother-in-law. And when we got on the set, I could tell that something was a little bit off, and I went up to one of the producers, Nina Noble, and I said, Nina, do you mind if I tell you something? Because you don't quite have this right. And she says, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, I evacuated with my family that day, and it was extremely humid and hot. Nobody on this set is sweating. And she said, oh, okay. And then about 10 minutes later, I saw about 3 or 4 makeup ladies with glycerin and water and spraying down everybody. That's important because anybody who evacuated knew how hot it was. It was ungodly hot, and you were stuck in traffic for 8 to 10 hours. What normally would have been a 2-hour drive from my family and I from New Orleans to Lafayette was 7.5 hours. Your car was starting to overheat, so you would have to turn your AC off and roll your windows down, and then you felt like you were literally in a sauna. So that was just one example of how these guys, Eric, David, Nina, how they cared enough to get it right. And I just want to let you guys know that as a New Orleanian, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
That you got it right. Now, my wife is also a New Orleanian, and she actually is from Treme, and I think she wants to say something.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you, because everything that I see on the show really brings me back to growing up in Treme. From Candy doing the second line, and I had a keen eye on that, because there's a certain way that that dance is done that people outside of New Orleans may not know. And you being a dancer, I watched you and I said, she got it. She really got it. My uncle was a big chief of the Yellow Pocahontas, so the Indian scenes are very authentic to me, because I remember Mardi Gras night tearing down the costume and starting all over again for the next year.
Who was your uncle?
He was Joe Dejean.
Oh, uh-huh. So
he was a big chief in the 60s.
Now, are you all related to Otto Dejean, who's on our show?
I don't know Otto, but probably
he's also related. Well, he's related to Duke Dejean from the Olympia. Are y'all related?
Quite possibly.
Yeah, I'm sure you
Dejean.
Are.
Dejean.
Yeah.
But thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much.
Okay.
Hi. There was a particular scene this year from where Delmon was arguing with
The two guys from New York?
Up in New York with the musicians. And yeah. I'm a New Orleanian, and speaking, it was just very real down to the word.
Well, thank you. I wrote that scene. If you didn't like it, I blame it on David, but I actually did write it.
I understand. Yeah, I just was trying to wonder where that came from, because literally there were words in that I've actually... The argument he had with his girlfriend later,
yeah,
that one, I said, yeah, I can say that.
Yeah. that seems very personal to me, actually, because I had all those conversations in New York with people, I'm not a musician, not about music, but about the city, about... Yeah. So I just extrapolated out to if I were a musician. And I know how people talk about trad jazz and the hall and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I certainly know how New Yorkers talk about New Orleans, because I go back and forth.
Yeah, it wasn't, yeah, just from, as you say, from the New Orleans standpoint. I'm a musician, just with that New Orleans, they argue, everybody can tell me about New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, that was the second episode, no, the first episode this year. And I was watching it in a bar, and when Delmon said, fuck y'all, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. There was this huge... Because everybody was going, is he going to say it? Is he going to say it? Is he going to say it?
Yeah, thank you.
And when we saw it in New York at the premiere, people kind of went, what's he so upset about? But thank you, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you both for being here and for being a part of this show. Thank you all for coming tonight.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.